Raymond M. Binkowski is not a physician or registered dietitian. The contents of this should not be taken as medical advice. It's not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any health problem, nor is it intended to replace the advice of a physician. Always consult your physician or qualified health professional on any matters regarding your health. If you're interested in learning more about the content in this podcast, webinar, or episode, click the link in the description or comments to learn more.
Okay, Raven Binkowski, we are going to talk about resolving joint pain. I'm excited for this. I actually even called my parents before this to make sure that I had all of their questions. I know I have my own. So I think it would be really great if we can start with actually supplements and food, and then we'll dive into joint pain, chronic pain. So let's start with supplements. I think that there's a lot of people that are struggling with trusting what to do, when to do it, what are reliable sources for different supplements. And it can be very complicated, and it can feel like you're in a sales world that maybe doesn't always have your best interest. So talk to me about what supplements you do recommend and why.
So, quality supplements taken in the amount shown in research to work often work, but they're just a supplement. They're not drugs. And for joint pain, some of the common things to look for are glucosamine, chondroitin, MSM, and hyaluronic acid. And ideally, you'll find one product that has all of those ingredients in it. The one that I've had success with, clients have had success with, is called Joint Care, and it's by a company called Beverly International. I believe that's a quality product. And one of the ways to look at a product and kind of judge its efficacy, and the average person's going to struggle, like by what measuring device can I measure whether or not a product is decent? And one of the ways to do that is, first and foremost, has the product been on the market for a while and not changed significantly? If something's working, the company's not going to change it. If they have a product that produces results, which means results are going to be repeat customers, there's not going to be significant changes to that product. Now, if a new ingredient in research has been shown to exert a positive effect, it might get added to the product, but it's not like they have a product for 18 months. And then there's a brand new product with totally different stuff, and they're telling you the same stuff, basically the same sales pitch. But that would be stuff to look for. Things like turmeric can help with inflammation. But if we look at a joint pain, glucosamine, chondroitin, MSM, hyaluronic acid, those are probably the big ones. And ironically, before we started today, we were talking about a prior injury that I have, and I had seen an orthopedic surgeon at one point. And I asked him about this, and this is going back over 20 years. I asked him about the joint products, glucosamine, chondroitin at that time, and then MSM were the big ones. And he said, years ago, I would have told you they were just basically black magic, pipe dreams. They didn't work. They were what was used by vets with animals, because that's where like the glucosamine chondroitin, if I remember right, came from. And he said, however, he goes, I was at an orthopedic conference this year, and the gentleman that was president of the orthopedic group nationally had said in his keynote before he had started the actual conference, said, hey, I want to share everything, something with everybody in here, because you guys are all doctors. Many of you have known me for a long time, know I've had chronic back pain and discomfort. And as a result, I greatly reduced playing my favorite game, which is golf. Well, I started taking these glucosamine tablets, and my back doesn't hurt as much, and I'm back to golfing almost as much as I used to. So my orthopedic doc said, so there has to be something to it, and there probably isn't much downside, so it's worth trying. So anytime we look at a supplement, it's going to be, has it been on the market for a while unchanged, or is it, just marketing and advertising, and they're going to have new marketing and advertising for a new product in a year and a half, 2 years. The next thing is you need to take enough to get the results that have been shown in research. Oftentimes, people will buy a product and they won't take enough of it, so it doesn't work. And enough is going to be determined by what was used in research. And with joint care, and I'm not a doctor, I'm not prescribing anything, I'm not practicing medicine without a license, but with joint care, what we've seen work for adults, for women, 4 to 6 per day, and for men, like 9 to 10 per day. And when you notice some of the pain, joint discomfort decrease, start reducing by 1 per day until you notice the pain come back. And you'll arrive somewhere between like 3 to 6 per day. And many people find that that keeps the, you know, it reduces joint pain enough that they end up being a repeat customer. Other things that help, collagen proteins have become really popular. That's another product that can help with joint discomfort. Ironically, you know, 20 years ago, we would have competitive bodybuilders getting kind of repetitive use injuries and imbalances about their joints, which we'll talk more about in a bit. And I would actually have them go buy sugar-free instant Jell-O, which was collagen, flavored collagen, right? And I would have them add that to a drink or a shake a few times a day. And they would often report that they had reduced joint pain and discomfort. So today, you don't have to buy sugar-free instant Jell-O. You can just go buy a collagen protein, and that's going to help with that. Another thing I believe has been shown to help with joint discomfort is magnesium. And that's probably a broader discussion I don't want to get into today, but definitely if you're deficient in vitamins and minerals, the body's not going to work right. And that would include with joint pain and discomfort.
So do you actually recommend that people get blood work to start off something like this? Like, okay, Ray, I'm experiencing shoulder pain. I've got knees that bother me constantly. Would you prefer that they do blood work to start, or would you have them start supplements right away and then go from there?
So the boilerplate legal answer to that is you should always consult with a doctor or physician before beginning this or any exercise, supplement, nutrition program. So that's going to be my CYA, and that'll actually be inserted. And if you're listening to this as a podcast or watching as a webcast, you're going to see that before. You've already seen me say that before we got started today. So blood work, there's certain vitamins and minerals that are not water soluble, which means if you take too much, they can be toxic. Vitamin D would be an example. In that case, it probably would be the right call to have blood work done. But as far as taking like glucosamine type products, I don't think you need to go to the doctor and get a blood draw first.
Okay, perfect. And really quickly then, because one red flag that I usually have whenever someone's trying to talk to me about supplements, and I just had a gentleman the other day, actually, because I'm prepping for my first marathon. He had all these supplements that he thought I should take. And you look through the list of what those supplements are going to do for me, and it sounds like I'm about to be an Olympian from how incredible these things are and all the promises. So the specific supplements that you just talked about, describe what they actually do and how they function and why that's important so that people really know what they're actually looking for and what those will do for them.
So the biggest thing they're going to do, without getting overly sciencey and technical, is going to be provide the raw materials used in tissue repair of joints and then help manage inflammation. It's that simple. Now, again, back to the marketing and the advertising, a lot of companies appear to be, say, a supplement company, but what they're really selling is advertising and marketing. And that's why they have a joint product today, and in 18 months, there's a new one and the old one's completely gone. Whereas if the product worked, customers would be coming back and you wouldn't discontinue it. So that's the biggest thing to look for. And then when we look at supplements for natural athletes, which would be your average middle-aged person, right? They're not playing a professional sport. They're not an Olympian. The supplements are just going to kind of fill in some of the gaps. They're going to maybe eliminate some deficiencies, but they're not drugs. You're not going to have a drug-like experience. And, you know, contrary to what you were told about the supplements for the marathon training, it's not going to make you an Olympian. It's just not going to do that.
So let's talk about CBD. I think that, of course, there are plenty of people that have tried it. My dog actually takes it and does really well with CBD, but I would love to hear your thoughts and if you believe in it, and if so, why?
I think it's a case of if there's no negative side effect, it's worth exploring, right? If it's not illegal, there's not a whole laundry list of downsides, meaning negative side effects, it's worth exploring and trying. And there's some people that have used CBD and they've had a great positive experience with it. And whether that's placebo or that is actually because of the CBD, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, their quality of life is better. And that's what matters. So if somebody is experiencing pain and discomfort and they try a CBD product and it works, they feel better, their quality of life is improved, then I would say go with it.
Okay, perfect. So at what point then, you know, for someone that's trying to figure out, when do I take painkillers? At what point do I need to have daily ibuprofen, or is that never supposed to be something that happens? Where's that line?
Yeah, I mean, I would struggle. I would say that if you're getting to the point where you're required to take an over-the-counter pain management product, like an Aleve, ibuprofen, aspirin, or whatever, I think if that's required, meaning your quality of life is impaired to the point that you have to do that, I think it's time to go see the doctor.
Okay.
That would be my line. Like I've never had a joint issue that has gotten to the point where I've regularly had to take something to manage the pain, over the counter or otherwise. And I think if you get to that point, you're working on an injury and it's time to go see a professional.
Okay. So one thing that I've noticed comes up a lot lately, and I don't know if it's because of things like elimination diets or just more awareness, but there's so much more chatter right now about certain foods either being inflammatory or anti-inflammatory. And I've heard things like all the way from gluten to just anything that's processed or things like that. Do you believe in foods being inflammatory or anti-inflammatory?
Yeah, foods can definitely be anti-inflammatory and they can also be inflammatory. It's kind of clear and it's been accepted for a long time that some essential fatty acids like omega-3 fats are anti-inflammatory. So you're in that, you know, okay, what does that mean? Like your fish oils, your olive oils have a high amount of omega-3 fat, and it's well accepted that that does have an anti-inflammatory property. Now, keep in mind, somewhere over the age of 30, we start to not break down the omega-3 fat into its constituent parts, DHA and EPA. So you might need to look for a product that specifically has those. But yes, there are anti-inflammatory foods. And on the flip side, there are inflammatory foods. And, you know, would I blame gluten? I don't know. I wouldn't say it's necessarily the gluten. I would say that today, sitting here at the time we're recording this, there's a lot of things that we do from the time a seed is planted to the crop's harvest that we didn't used to do. And as a result of that, what's coming with the gluten? Okay, so is it the gluten, or is there something from the day the seed goes into the earth to the time it's harvested to the time it's processed and put in a box, a bag, a can, or a jar that has changed it? So I think it's probably less of gluten and more in what we've done to the products we get gluten from. Not to say that there is not intolerance that's related to foods that have gluten. 100% there is. Like I do know people that have an inflammatory response when they eat certain foods or they drink certain alcohols. you know, certain beers. 100% that's legitimate. Now, on that same point, do I think everybody is gluten intolerant? No. Do I think everybody has celiac disease? No. Do I think a lot of people think they have one or the other or both? Yes. Do I think they're right? No. But I definitely think there's something going on with our tolerance of what have been common foods in the North American diet that we didn't see, say, 60, 70 years ago, 100%. And I 100% believe that it does cause inflammation. There's definitely something going on. And this could be a separate, entirely separate podcast, but if you just look at the data from the standpoint of the incidence of type 1 diabetes, we see a lot more of that. Autoimmune diseases, vitiligo, we see a lot more of that. Autism, we see a lot more of that. And the quote unquote see a lot more of that is not all because it went underdiagnosed 30 or 40 years ago. Something's definitely different. So yes, I mean, I would say there is an inflammatory component to food, or there can be for some people. And there's also an anti-inflammatory component or property of food.
Okay. If someone is going to make some big changes in their diet, either removing or adding in things, how long do you think it could take for them to actually see results from that? Is it 24 hours? Is it 3 months? Like, how long do they need to stay in the boat to figure out if something actually does work for them?
Well, I don't know that I can give the exact answer to that. I don't know that the answer would be the same for everybody. But when we look at, say, an elimination diet, which means you're going to remove something, it all goes back to science, right? Like, we change one variable at a time. We don't pick three things to take out of our daily diet, because if we notice a difference somewhere, somehow, which of the three things is it? Or is it the combination of having removed the three things at the same time and not related to one of the three? So you always want to pick one thing. I do know, because I struggled with lactose intolerance for a long time until I quit drinking milk on a daily basis. It could be a matter of hours where I had milk or a large amount of dairy, say pizza, where I was sick and miserable. Like, it could be a matter of hours. So that being true, and that being true for a lot of people that have sensitivities like that, I would imagine it could be 7 to 10 days or less.
Mm-hmm. So what are three foods that you would say across the board you would love for anyone that's looking for an anti-inflammatory food? What are the top three that you would love to see people try?
Carlson's liquid fish oil comes in a glass bottle. It's lemon flavor. You can get it on Amazon. Probably turmeric. And then a third thing, I don't even know. I don't know that I would have a third one. Those would be the two.
Okay.
Maybe tart cherry extract.
Okay. And what about three foods that you would highly recommend avoiding to almost anyone when it comes to being inflammatory?
So everybody's going to be different. So it's hard to label our blanket and say these three foods for all. I don't think that's a fair and reasonable statement, because there's plenty of people that can eat any and everything and never have an adverse reaction. And there's some people that can't have two pieces of bread, or they can't have two IPA beers because within 3 hours, they've got gastrointestinal distress. And then they wake up the next day and they're bloated and swollen and their joints hurt. So I don't think, I think I would struggle to recommend three foods that for all you must avoid.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So we're going to move on. I want to talk about chronic pain today and joint pain. So breaking them apart specifically, because I think it's important for us to keep joint pain separate because it's a different animal, but chronic pain, maybe focusing more on the muscular side of things. So the few that I came up with that I would love to hear your input on would be lower back pain, constantly having like the tight calves, and then also neck or shoulder tension that could even add up to headaches. So walk me through any others that you typically hear about when it comes to more muscular and how you go about addressing anything like that.
So I think you don't want to do this, but we're going to do it anyways. We need to tie the two of them together. So normally, like if we look at what's contributing, like what's the source, what's the root cause, in all likelihood, there's an imbalance somewhere. And that's what's causing it. It could be an imbalance in regards to overuse, too much pushing and not enough pulling. It could be an imbalance of the quads are way too dominant for the hamstrings. And now there's an issue because of imbalance about the knee joint. So I think really it comes down to managing the imbalance. Now, when we look at the soft tissue side of things, we look at the muscle. One, are you hydrated? And I can't say this for sure, and I can't quote the source, and I don't follow ball sports outside of the training aspect. Like, I'm interested in training. I'm not interested in watching the game. Don't really care. But Tom Brady's about my age, and I remember seeing a couple years ago when he was still playing and extending his career, his trainer dude had said one of the biggest things that they saw a benefit for him was making sure he drank more water in terms of, you know, joints, everything that we're talking about in terms of chronic pain and joint pain. So I think making sure you're adequately hydrated is a must do. And then I think soft tissue work. So self-myofascial release, whether it's going in and or in lieu of getting regular deep tissue massage work. So I think there's tremendous value and benefit to getting regular deep tissue work by a skilled deep tissue practitioner, not going to a spa and having a spa day, but actual deep tissue work. And this goes back, so long time ago, I had had chronic issues directly related to training in an imbalanced fashion. So I was the root cause. The way I was lifting weights was creating my issues. And I promote two bodybuilding contests every year. And for a number of years, I had two chiropractors that would do my contests. And one year I asked one of them, I said, let me ask you this. My massage therapist said that if I would just get a massage like every 3 weeks, it would resolve a lot of the issues I'm having with my one shoulder. And he said, she's right. You have a really good massage therapist. I said, come on, are you serious? It sounds like a sales pitch. And he goes, no, it's not. In fact, I was a massage therapist before I went to chiropractic school. And part of what happens when we have an imbalance is the soft tissue is keeping the joints out of place and it's creating the imbalance. So the chiropractor can put the joint back, but the tissue will pull it back out of place oftentimes. And if you just get that soft tissue work and you get it to relax, you can resolve the imbalance and you probably don't have to see the chiropractor as much. So for some folks, it might be out of reach to get regular soft tissue work, but you can go get one of the trigger point guns, like the Theragun. You can order a couple lacrosse balls. You can use a league ball, a softball, a tennis ball, a racquetball, though tennis ball is often too soft and it gives too much. And you can get a point load, like trigger point, onto the tissue where it's actually it has a trigger point and get it to release. So that's probably one of the biggest things that you can do is going to be either go get deep tissue work from a therapist or do it yourself with a Theragun or a lacrosse ball and then make sure you're hydrated.
So let's say that someone does come into you, and I think that this is probably the most popular one that I hear. They come in and say, I've had severe lower back pain. It aches every day. I have to stop what I'm doing if I'm working outside too long and take a break, things like that. What's the roadmap that you're going to follow for somebody with low back pain? What are you going to look at and address immediately?
Drink more water. Learn a quality dynamic warm-up for the lower extremities. And then you're probably going to find that there are a number of muscles that are tight relative to the other muscles. So stretching the muscles of the lower extremities, particularly the hamstrings, and then learning some, you know, some deep tissue work for the QL, the quadratus lumborus muscle, for the psoas, iliopsoas, piriformis. So some specific dynamic warm-up. We never stretch or do mobility work when we're cold. The reason for that, and this is kind of a cool thing to do, especially if you have kids, go buy some old school silly putty, form it into a cube, put it in the freezer, take it out of the freezer, take one of those plastic mallets with the orange hammers, and hit the cube. The cube will crack. Now, silly putty will stretch a mile if it's warm, but yet when it's cold, it will crack. And that's a great way to look at our connective tissue, our soft tissue. So you always want to be warm first, and a way to do that's a dynamic warm-up. And where possible, depending on where you're hearing or viewing this, I'll put a link to a dynamic warm-up we've used with great results. We used it with, over 1,000 athletes, hundreds of everyday folks. So warm-up, then some joint mobility, flexibility stuff, and then back to that deep tissue work with a lacrosse ball, a Theragun, or by a therapist.
Perfect. So we'll move on to joint pain. What are the most typical things that you're hearing? What are people dealing with the most?
Probably the biggest thing that I hear, or the number one joint issue that I hear in conversation with clients, is knee discomfort and pain. And almost every incidence of that is going to be back to the imbalance, right? An imbalance on a joint of any machine under the sun will lead to a failure. You can think of the joints on an automobile, like a ball joint. If there's an imbalance, the joint will fail. That's true. It's basic physics. It's true of any and all structures, including the structure of the human. And what does that mean? And what does it look like? Another cool experiment to do with kids: take an egg out of the fridge, put it in the palm of your hand, stand over the sink, and squeeze as hard as you can. Now, some kids' hands might not be big enough to do this, but if the egg is in the palm of the hand, the egg will not break. The sum of the forces about the egg are equal, so nothing happens. Now, if you move that egg slightly out of the palm of your hand and you squeeze, you don't even have to squeeze that hard, it breaks. That is a great example of what happens when we have an imbalance about the joints of any machine, any structure, including the human body. So that knee discomfort is usually there's an imbalance somewhere about the knee. And in my experience, 9 out of 10 times, what's causing that imbalance is old shoes that are wore out. And I've had, 60-year-old avid golfer, plays 18 to 36 holes a day when the weather's nice, like literally 7 days a week, tell me his knees hurt. When I golf, I'm like, how old are your golf shoes? Man, I have like 12 or 15 pairs of golf spikes, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, it's your shoes. How old are they? I didn't ask how many you had. And that's always the answer I get. Well, how old are they? So this individual went the next time he golfed, which was like the next day, went to the pro shop, bought a new brand new pair of shoes, played 36, called me. He's like, my knees don't hurt. I'm like, I know. I told you. Your shoes were probably wore out. Now take all of those golf shoes and throw them out. I had a client run the New York Marathon this past fall. She started to get knee discomfort and pain, said your shoes are wore out. I had a female bikini competitor from the West Coast last summer, was getting ready to compete early fall, started to have knee issues, pain. I said, get new gym shoes, bought new gym shoes. In days, the pain was dissipating and then it was gone. So usually what we see is the gym shoes are wearing, they're wearing unevenly, and it's changing the mechanics. It's created an imbalance, and because it's changed the mechanics of the knee, and we start to get pain and discomfort. And if you think of that knee joint as like a door hinge just rotates about one axis, right? And it works totally fine, nice and smooth. But if I walk up to my office door and I jam a crowbar next to one of the hinges, which expands one side of the hinge and tries to compress the other side, that door is not going to open and close very smoothly. Same thing with the knee joint. And that is often the result of having your shoes being worn out. It's changed your gait. It's changed your movement mechanics, and it's created that imbalance. So if we eliminate what's causing the imbalance, the imbalance will go away. And with it, the pain will subside and go away.
So how can someone go about making sure that they get the right shoes then? What do you look for?
Every 2 to 4 months, throw your shoes out and buy new ones. Don't keep them to do housework, yard work, wash the car, clean the basement, put stuff in the attic, get the holiday decorations out, take the kids to school, walk the kids to the bus stop, throw them out. And good shoes, I mean, I would not buy cheap discount department store brand shoes, right? Don't buy the discount store branded really, really cheap shoes. I think as long as you're buying a quality shoe, you're probably going to be fine. I don't like the squishy bottom gym shoes because the foot can compress the shoe unequally, and that soft squishy material will wear more oftentimes, not all times, oftentimes than some of the other shoe sole material. But I think as long as you're buying quality shoes, you're going to be fine as long as you don't keep them for 3 or 4 years. You know, I went through this. Like, how did I learn this? Like, most of what I've learned by making a lot of mistakes myself or working with others that have made mistakes. And once you see a same mistake over and over again leads to the same problem for almost everybody, you realize, well, if you don't make that mistake, you don't have that problem. So I had been having knee pain and discomfort and went to my chiropractor and I said, man, my knees have been killing me, especially this one. He said, well, all right, let me look at it. He said, how old are your shoes? And I did what everybody does with me. How old are your shoes? And I'm like, they look like brand new. And he said, I didn't ask that. How old are they? And I'm like, they look like brand new. I only wear them in the gym. Like, I carry them in. They've never even been worn in the parking lot. He's like, I didn't ask you that. How old are they? And I was like, let me think about it. I think they're like 3 years old. He's like, and how many days a week do you exercise? And I'm like, yeah, but I haven't, like, they're not even dirty. They look like the day they came out of the box. He goes, your shoes are shot. He's like, I'll adjust your knees, but it's not going to matter if you keep wearing those old shoes. Go buy new shoes. And I did, and it resolved the issue. So that's always been my go-to since then. Then we do have some knee rehab, prehab exercises we've had success with, but oftentimes we don't need those if we get new shoes.
So what kind of shoes do you train in?
I train in my socks.
And why is that?
Because I train in my home gym and I can. If I was going to a commercial gym on leg day, anytime I would be pushing with my feet, I'm going to wear a solid rubber sole gym shoe, something like a Chuck Taylor or Vans. If I'm going to be doing upper body, then, you know, I typically buy Asics. For no reason other than back when my chiropractor told me to buy new shoes, that happened to be what I bought. And I'll shop the clearance rack at a shoe store, or I'll shop discount like 2 years ago color combos on Amazon, and I'll buy two pairs at a time.
So what makes for a lower body day when you are weight training, what makes Converse and Vans appealing to you? Why those?
Well, when anytime, like, even when we walk, right? When we take a step and we push on the ground is pushing an equal amount back to us. It's equal and opposite, right? It's physics. So if it's squat day, if it's leg day and we're going to squat, or it's leg day and we're going to leg press, and we have squishy bottom shoes on, when we go to push against the ground, or we go to push the platform on the sled of the leg press, the first thing that's going to happen is the shoes are going to compress, and then we're going to start pushing the ground or pushing the platform. That's not going to happen if it's a solid rubber slab under your foot or if you're in your socks. And then the other thing is it's not likely to compress unequally and then create that crowbar in the door hinge scenario I already described. So for me, that's why. And the Chuck Taylor, I mean, Chuck Taylor's got popular on leg day or in weightlifting, probably solely because of Louis Simmons and Westside Barbell Club back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the reason I wear them and still wear them. If I go to a commercial gym and I'm going to train legs, that's what I'm going to wear.
Okay. So for those people that have seen squat shoes and things like that with an elevated heel, why do people wear those and how do they know if that could be right for them too?
Why they're wearing them or why there's a wedge in the heel, I believe that's to put more emphasis on the quads and the squat. Is that not right? That's what I believe it to be. Why you would have to wear weightlifting shoes beyond that, I don't know. I mean, I think you do just fine in Chuck Taylor's. And there's plenty of people that are doing world record squats in Chucks and world record deadlifts in Chucks.
Mm-hmm. I know some people like them because of ankle mobility being a problem. So that slightly elevated heel allows a little bit more range of motion, but it's kind of putting a band-aid on something too.
Yeah,
so.
Maybe we should adjust the ankle mobility.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then for something like knee pain specifically, and I'll give you a few more like this too, where you can walk me through how to know what path is right. For something like knee pain, and it's ongoing, it's chronic at this point, how do you know when to strength train for that, when to stretch, how much of each? How would you typically approach that?
I mean, if it's something that's every day and it's not going away, the pain's not reduced, it's constantly the same day in and day out, I'd probably go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Where you can't attribute, I did this and it gets worse, I didn't do this and it feels fine today, I would probably be going to the doctor if it's an everyday thing. You know, that my experience has been that the body will tap you on the shoulder and politely ask for a break a couple times, and it will do that with some slight discomfort. If you ignore that tap on the shoulder long enough, you'll have a chronic issue, and eventually the body is going to get the break that it's been asking for in the form of an injury. Mm-hmm. And it's far better to be proactive and address it before you have a full-blown injury than have to be reactive and then approach it from the standpoint of recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's chronic like that, I'm going to the doctor. Beyond that, it's always going to be the same thing. Like, what can I be doing that's creating an imbalance about my knee? How old are my shoes? Am I hydrated? Am I staying hydrated? Am I training in a balanced manner? So I would use a combination of everything.
Mm-hmm. So if someone does believe that they have something like a muscular imbalance where maybe the quads are over tightened and overworking, the hamstrings are elongated, something like that, are you going to attack that by stretching in front and trying to strengthen in back?
I would say yes, but I don't think, in my experience, most of the people, I don't think it needs to be that complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in physical therapy, the physical therapist will usually say, well, you have an imbalance, your quads are way, way more dominant than your hamstrings and they're tight, and that they'll do that stuff. But like my scope of practice, if you will, usually we don't even need to get that deep into it.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the other big things that you do hear about what types of joint pain are typical?
Plantar fasciitis is huge, and often times you could get a relatively significant amount of relief just by stretching the calves and the hamstrings.
Mm-hmm.
And staying hydrated, right? It's going to go back to the hydration, but stretching the calves and hamstrings often go a long way to resolving that plantar tendon being pulled flat to the floor and inflamed. Shoulder, like we did a project for 3M years ago to eliminate lost time in the workplace because of injury. Their two biggest injuries at the plant facilities we worked with were shoulder, low back. So we've already talked a little bit about the low back. Shoulder would be the other one. You know, if you're doing a lot of pushing, you should be doing an equal amount of pulling. And a lot of people, especially, you know, adolescent males, all they want to do and talk about with weights is bench press, bench press, bench press. And there's never a conversation, or they're never celebrating how much they did in a row. And that starts setting them up. Pretty soon it's 20 years later and they've been working out in a very bench press dominant manner, and they haven't done a lot going the other direction. But same thing with the shoulder, you know, strengthening the muscle groups that support and stabilize the shoulder, and then training in a balanced fashion. If, you know, for, if you're going to push three times, you should pull three times.
And would you ever argue that someone should be doing even more of one side to offset a balance, an imbalance, or is it okay to be doing equal pulling and pushing, or could they actually do more pulling?
So I had an eye surgeon as a client a long time ago, and given what he did for work, you know, he was, everything was like this. So shoulders were rolled, head was down, hands were down. And when we programmed for him, we did designed his workouts and whatever. I don't recall trying to put more stuff going in one direction than the other direction. I think the fact that he just didn't do anything in the opposite direction was where the issue was from. And just by adding some basic, you know, chest supported seated rows, some barbell or dumbbell rows, some lat pull downs, that was enough. As I recall, I'd have to go back and shoot, it's been years. I'd have to go back and see if we have digital copies of his programming, but I don't believe we ever had to, you know, do four times as many rows as we did bench presses type thing.
Okay. That's perfect. So again, kind of similar, I guess, unless you do have any more typical joints that you're working with.
No, knee is number one. The low back and shoulder are probably second. And then I do hear a lot of people with plantar fasciitis, even just in general conversation, that's common.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when do you refer out? And I think it's important for people to know in general that everyone, no matter their field, does have a scope of practice. So if a personal trainer is trying to sell someone on, I can help you, you know, we're going to keep pushing through this or something like that, where is your line and when should people be referred out?
If it's not getting better and we've gone to the place where it's chronic, it's an everyday thing, like something's not right. And more of the same is going to get you more of the same. I mean, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a physical therapist. I can't do MRIs. I can't do any imaging. So I can't see what's going on outside of looking at where does it hurt and how does it move? Scale 1 to 10, how severe is the pain? That's about it for my toolbox, right? So you really need to go see somebody that is a professional and has access in the experience and the education to use those other diagnostic tools.
Mm-hmm. And do you prefer that people try to get imaging right away? How much does an MRI
I mean, that's not my call. And that's way outside my scope of what I do for a living. Like, I'm not qualified for that, but I think having had clients go do that, having my kids who are athletes have to go, the good practice is going to be a conservative approach, and they're not going to go right to imaging. And then the other sad reality is today, and until certain boxes are checked, insurance will never pay for imaging anyways.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So I would love to wrap up today talking about something that I continue to hear more and more about. And we discussed this already, but I have a friend that's very fit, very, very healthy, and was absolutely shocked this year to learn that she has early onset osteoporosis, and was, again, completely shocked by that, thought that she was doing all the right things. How do you address osteoporosis from an exercise standpoint and also potentially supplements, if you believe in that?
So, as we've said in the past in other conversations, the human body is built to survive. And if you place increased demands on the body typically will step up and respond to those demands. So if we progressively overload the muscle, the body says we need to build a stronger muscle. If you load the bone, the skeletal system, the body says we need to build a stronger skeletal system. And what that means for osteopenia or full-blown osteoporosis is that there's significant benefit to weight training, because weight training has been shown to increase bone density. So one of the best things you can do is weight train. And you're not going to get that benefit from cardio. You're not going to get that benefit from endurance training, whether it's running, cycling, rowing, swimming. You're just not. You have to pick up heavy things. You know, back to like we've said in prior conversations, everybody has to weight train. And it's not, you know, again, back to the body is built to survive. The body is going to do what it can to respond to that increased demand. It's going to do that in regards to bone density, and it's going to do that in regards to connective tissue integrity as well. Like if the body realizes the tendons and ligaments need to be stronger, it's going to start to build stronger connective tissue. It's going to build a stronger muscle, and it's going to build a stronger structure. So weight training is one of the best things you can do. We had women in their 60s and 70s that had osteoporosis and had the DEXA scans and all the bone density stuff done, diagnosed, the doctors, all of that, just by incorporating consistent 3 to 4 day per week load-bearing activity, resistance training. What do we mean? Weight training, picking up heavy things and putting them down. They saw decreases, or they saw increases in bone density. So the one of the best things you can do is weight train. Everybody has to weight train a couple days a week. It's just the way it is. Like, nobody invited me to sit at the table when they designed the human body and how it works. But what I've experienced and what I've witnessed, everybody needs to weight train. And the osteoporosis is just one more example where we get a benefit from weight training that can offset some of the osteoporosis.
So what about supplements then? Do you have supplements that you recommend? Do you believe that it helps and works
for bone density? So if you read some research, and it's been a while since I've read some research, only 10 to 20% of dietary vitamins and minerals are absorbed. So that being the case, I don't think taking the supplemental calcium is going to hurt. It's probably a good idea, but it's not the panacea that everybody makes it out to be. They'll just take calcium. Well, you're only going to absorb 10 to 20% of it. We'll drink milk for strong bones. Well, the absorption of calcium from milk is so poor that they have to fortify it with vitamin D. What do you mean? Well, you don't absorb much of the calcium from the milk, so they add vitamin D to increase the amount you absorb. Now, that being the case, back in the 90s, when I changed my lifestyle around and lost a bunch of weight, I quit drinking milk, and I have not regularly bought milk for my personal consumption since 1996. And I'm almost 50 years old, and I don't have weak bones. I don't have weak bones because I pick up heavy things. My kids don't drink milk on a regular basis. It's rare that we have milk in our refrigerator. Rare enough that I'd say maybe 4 times a year, there's a half gallon of milk in the fridge.
So if someone is trying to get started with weight training then, and they want to see those benefits, but they're scared or nervous, and maybe part of the reason why they're experiencing the early onset is they've never weight trained, how would you recommend that they get started so that they do feel safe?
There's no reason to reinvent the wheel with anything in life. You know, find somebody that knows how to do it and do what they're doing. You know, when we look at weight training, find a competent coach or trainer. Like, I have a lady that's somewhat new to weight training, last like 2 years. She's in her early 50s. I told her she had to get out of squatting in a Smith machine, and she needed to learn how to barbell back squat. She needed to be comfortable with that. And she was worried because I'm not there. It, you know, it's virtual. Our relationship coaching wise is a it's a digital one. It's virtual. It's over the internet. And it took her going and trying one time. And she's, you know, we're now about a month later and she's totally comfortable and confident doing a barbell back squat in a rack, no more Smith machine. So just fine. And, you know, that involved me giving her some basic coaching. Simple to do, but there's plenty of assets and resources on the internet where you can do that. And then I would be shocked if almost every adult in America today doesn't know at least one person that knows how to correctly lift weights and could show them in minutes.
Mm-hmm. And what would you recommend from a volume standpoint? If you are just getting started, how many times a week would you like to see someone in a weight room and how much time spent? What does that look like?
Just had a guy brand new to me, East Coast, 50s, hasn't worked out regularly in a gym in a couple years. So in when he did, he wasn't like an active physique competitor, athlete, bodybuilder, or whatever. So he's just returning. I would say brand new, completely deconditioned, detrained. I would say 3 days a week is fine. I think you can do a whole body workout 3 days a week. There's no reason to overdo it. If you haven't squatted outside of to sit in a chair or go to the bathroom, I wouldn't go get under a loaded barbell and start squatting for three sets of 12. You won't be, if you're middle-aged, you're not going to walk tomorrow. I definitely, if you're middle-aged and you're brand new to the gym, I wouldn't do lunges. And it, you know, starting out, it could be simply, I would do an overhead press. I'd do a front press. I'd do a row. I'd do a squat and I'd do a hinge. And I would say that that would be adequate. So like a dumbbell overhead shoulder press, a dumbbell bench press, a dumbbell row, a stiff leg deadlift, and a squat. And you could probably air squat to get started and that's going to be enough. And like I told that new client that's in his 50s a week ago, I want you to go back to the gym. So if you overdo it today, you're going to take 4 or 5 days off. And every time when you're brand new returning, you take 4 or 5 days off. When you go back, it's going to be Groundhog Day. You're going to have that same pain and discomfort. So it's better to sandbag it, be conservative, go easy. Maybe you just do air squats today, but that's more squats than you did last week for the entire week. But then we can go back in 2 days and we can do it again. We're not so uncomfortable and miserable and sore that you can go back in and do the movements again. So I would say 3 days a week, I'd pick 5 large multi-joint lifts and I would start there. And I wouldn't even worry like on the squat. You don't need to worry about starting out squatting a bunch of weight. And I'll give you an example of that too. Back when I was making every mistake under the sun, I didn't know anything about this. I was in the gym. It occurred to me that they had all of these machines and exercises for legs, none of which I had done. Some of them I'd never seen. And I'd seen these two fit dudes using this leg machine and they got done. And in typical young male fashion, they left all their plates on the machine. And I watched them doing it, both of them back and forth. I'm like, all right, I'll go give that a shot. And I walked up, got in the machine, stood up, the safety bars released, and I went down and I just kept going down. I got closed in the machine. I had to climb out the side. Embarrassed as hell. Like, look at the fat guy, brand new to training legs, closed up in the machine, climbing out the side. So you don't need to start with weight. I would have been fine, one, to understand how the machine actually worked and how the safety bars worked and understand that as soon as you stand up, the safeties release until you put them back. And then two, I would have been better off just using the machine with no weight on it. It would have been enough. I hadn't trained legs.
Yeah. So if someone does all of those things, particularly with something like osteoporosis, can they expect to actually reverse what has already happened? Or does that look more like neutralizing it, stopping it from progressing? What's the expectation?
I think most people now, for women, middle-aged women, there's a component related to hormones that's going to be beyond my ability to speak intelligently about, to the extent I wouldn't feel comfortable going down that road. Removing that, yes, the overwhelming majority of people are going to see an increase in bone density by doing load-bearing activities, i.e. weight training. Okay. So I would be surprised if she didn't see a positive outcome from introducing weight training to her daily routine.
Okay. So not just neutralizing, but potentially actually seeing an improvement.
Yeah. You know, that the body is, again, we're going to keep going back to you. And this is why science, like, you have to work with how the human body works. The body is built to survive. And if demands are being placed on the body to maintain or increase bone density, that's what it's going to do. If the body is not realizing there's demands to maintain bone density, then it won't. Mm-hmm. We're going to make it overly simplified and terribly generalized, but that's the way it works. If the body doesn't have a demand to maintain muscle mass, it's going to get rid of it. Because it sees muscle as expensive and it wants to save money. It wants to cost. Kelsey doesn't need strong quads, glutes, and hamstrings because she hasn't squatted in 3 years. So we'll reduce the amount of mass in the quads, glutes, and hamstrings because she's not using it anyways. Mm-hmm. Now, on the flip side, if you increase the demands on those muscle groups, the body's going to maintain them. And then if you progressively overload them, the body's going to increase the size of them.
Oh, makes perfect sense. Thank you. You answered all of my questions. You answered all of my parents' questions. You did it all. So thank you, Ray.
Yeah, for sure. And it's don't make more out of any of it than it needs to be. You know, keep things simple. The biggest thing is buy new shoes. If it becomes a chronic everyday thing where you're having to lean on, it's required to take the over-the-counter pain management stuff. It's time to see a doctor. But that being said, there's a lot you can do proactively, and there's a lot you can do from a maintenance standpoint to manage the imbalances. I mean, I, just like I said in prior conversations, I work on balance pretty much every time I train. I also do trigger point therapy through self-myofascial release by using a lacrosse ball and a Theracane. Pretty much every time I'm in my gym, I'm using a lacrosse ball, I'm using a Theracane. Mm-hmm. And if I don't, those imbalances are going to start to happen, and I'm going to start to have recurring discomfort and joint pain, and eventually it'll be chronic.
Mm-hmm. And where can people find things like that, you said?
Which things?
Theraguns, anything like that.
Amazon. Okay. You can buy a lacrosse ball at any sporting goods store. They're cheap. You can buy a Theragun. I mean, I would go on Amazon. You can buy the stretch cane. There's all different names for them, but it looks like a hook. Mm-hmm. Here you go.
Look at it. So what kind of things do you do with that?
Dig into my pack. Trap. Muscles of the rotator cuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you to apply a one single point of pressure to like a trigger point. And that, like, we didn't cover this, but that's one of the shortcomings of the foam rollers. Like, every gym today has foam rollers. Most people have a foam roller at their house. Those are great, but it distributes the load, the pressure, over too great a surface area. So you really can't get that trigger point work. You can't get that deep tissue work, that you can't get that myofascial release, but you can from the lacrosse ball, you can from the guns, and you can from that Theracane.
Mm-hmm. So along those same lines, then, talk to me about dry needling. What is it? Do you believe in it? And what does it do?
So full disclosure, I have not had it done because I don't do needles. Although I believe I would benefit significantly from it. The way it's been explained to me is one example, and this is by a nurse and massage therapist, somebody that's worked in massage therapy for north of a decade. She actually worked for me on Division I athletes. So she worked on legitimate athletes that were heavily muscled with a lot of muscle mass to work through and get to a trigger point. It, you know, she said dry needling can do in one session what it would take me multiple sessions to do if I could even do it. Mm-hmm. So it's a faster way to get a trigger point to release, is my understanding of it. And there's all kinds of benefits, you know, not just limited to joint pain, but there's benefits even for many people that suffer from migraines.
And so with dry needling, then, are those quick little 10-minute appointments? How does that work?
I don't know, because I haven't done it. You're not going to hear me say that all that often. Well, I think that's twice in 2 days, but yeah, that's one of the, I don't have an answer to that.
Those are all my questions.
If you like our content, be sure to subscribe to our channel. Leave us a comment below. Also, be sure to check us out on your favorite podcast provider. See the links in the description below.